Welcome to the podcast, Speak Your Peace. This is a podcast about Utah's history produced by the Utah Department of Culture and Community Engagement. I'm Brad Westwood, Senior Public Historian. My job is to make the very best, the most interesting, the most accurate history of Utah accessible to the widest audience. If there's one place, one podcast to get your Utah history fix, I hope this is the place. If you subscribe to this podcast, or this is the first time you're listening, I hope you'll go back and listen to the dozens of other prior episodes. Please also rate and review Speak Your Peace on iTunes, Google, and elsewhere. My guest is longtime book dealer, social critic, historian, and dear friend Ken Sanders. We're going to be discussing today rare books, Counterculture Utah, his life and his interaction with so many other people here in Utah for over how many years?
Almost 50 years I've been in the book trade now, Brad.
Wow. I've asked Ken to just speak about these things and whatever else he finds interesting. So thank you so much, Ken, for being here.
It's my pleasure, Brad.
First question I want to ask you is, you got into this gig of rare book dealing and collecting as a young boy. Tell us that story.
Well, I always read books. I just devoured books. I had to have books. And it was a pretty driving factor in my life. So back in grade school, I'd read every book I could get my hands on. I used to live for the weekly reader and the scholastic books that once a month.
Ditto.
And I would trade in soda pop bottles for nickels for.
And did you get the books at school? Did they have book fairs where you could bring your money?
We didn't do book fairs in my day, Brad, but they had a monthly shipment that came. And so the teacher would call, you know, far less than half the class even bought books. Mm-hmm. And usually it'd be a book or two books. I was always the last kid called because there was an entire box of books for me.
Well, and where did that love of reading transfer into some kind of retail experience?
Well, I was a real comic book collector in my youth, although my mom in the 50s only allowed me to read. We had a subscription to Walt Disney's comics and stories, but all the good stuff, you know, the superheroes and the science fiction and the horror, you weren't really allowed that at that age. So I would found out I could kind of horse trade comic books. And, you know, if I could buy one for a nickel and sell it for a dime, it wasn't so much I was in business, but that meant now I can have two more comic books in my collection.
Well, and so comic books, you as a voracious reader also kind of were very much aware of what was going around you. I mean, this was a time of great change in Utah.
Oh, my goodness. I grew up in South Salt Lake. They've rebranded themselves from the City of Industry to, I forget what the new slogan is on the water tank out there. When I was a kid, there was no Interstate 15 or 80. I recall vividly them tearing the neighborhoods up just blocks from my house to shove that Interstate 80 freeway, you know, from State Street all the way up Parley's Canyon. The old way used to be you went up 21st South until it turned into Parley's Way. And then on the old US 40, you crisscrossed the canyon high up on these rickety bridges that took you back and forth until you reached the summit, which was much, much higher than today. I'd say 50 feet at least higher. And other than Flinders Mountain Meadow Ranch and the ruins of the old Pony Express and the Wells Fargo buildings and one old ranch that's still there on the right-hand side, there weren't any buildings between Parley Summit and Silver Creek Junction.
Wow.
None.
That's an interesting memory, really. And in that time, you also were seeing a lot of post-war families moving in, the suburban sprawls going on across.
I grew up on Blair Street, just off 27th South in South Salt Lake. There was an open ditch that ran down the south side of the street, and every spring and fall, there were thousands and thousands of sheep that were herded down out of the mountains to I have no idea where they went to the West.
Somewhere out in the West Desert.
Somewhere. And back every twice a year. The first five homes on Blair Street were built in 1950 on the out of an old swamp, and that connected to the rest of Blair Street. Our house was the fifth house, and it was where the sidewalk ended. An old Blair Street began, and it was mysterious because the trees, there was no curbs and gutters and sidewalks, and the trees formed canopies that shaded the entire street.
So whereabouts is Blair? Tell me.
27th South and 3rd, 4th East.
Interesting. Well, so can this voracious reading, this interesting kind of childhood growing up, you were quite an observant individual, tracking a lot of things. When the counterculture, when things started to bloom with in the 50s and 60s, I mean, there was a massive transformation of popular culture.
Well, really in the early 60s is when it began. I mean, in the 50s, I was watching Howdy Doody show and reading Walt Disney comics. But the early 60s, my first big time, I mean, I loved the Beatles and I loved the Rolling Stones. I didn't really care for the Beach Boys. I have a better appreciation of them now. But my band was the Yardbirds, Five Live Yardbirds, with Eric Slohan Clapton, who's now turned into some kind of anti-vaxxer nut. I'm embarrassed to have ever liked him.
But in any case, there was some, you know, things changing going on. What were those changes?
Well, when I was I was a serious book collector at the age of 14. My grandparents took me and my little brother to Southern California, which is quite a cultural eye-opening from a native Utahn, shall we say. And we did the usual tourist sites, Knott's Berry Farm, that sort of thing. Disneyland didn't want to let me in as a kid price because I was too big. And they didn't believe I was only 14. And how do you prove it?
So on that trip, no Disneyland.
I've forgotten. But I didn't care because the only place I wanted to go was Bertrand Smith's Acres of Books, 240 Long Beach Boulevard, Long Beach, California. And Pop, as we called my grandfather, he drove me over there in a little battleship gray Ford, and he sat outside that bookstore and smoked unfiltered Camel cigarettes that he would later die a horrible death from at age 62. And I spent hours inside Acres of Books, and I bought a beautifully illustrated Alice in Wonderland. I bought a Arabian Nights illustrated by Maxfield Parrish. I bought a gigantic Alice in Wonderland coloring book, and I bought a folio-sized edition of The Raven by Poe with engravings by Gustave Doré.
You know, those were wonderful artists that were really being rediscovered in the 1960s, Parrish and
yes.
Poe, and there was just a whole lot of literary flowering going on.
It was really, going back to my early childhood, a lot of times it was the art that got me into really good literature. From you can argue, the Oz books I love, there were 40 of them, and most of them were illustrated by John Arneil, and that was the portal. His wonderful artwork brought the books to life. I got into Arabian Nights through the Maxfield Parrish. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd never seen artwork like that before. It just really stimulated the imagination. And Gustave Doré, he did hundreds and hundreds of works, from the Bible to Dante to Milton to Coleridge to Poe to you name it. And it was really the artwork that got me into, you know, my first experiences with the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam were through the artwork when I bought them when I was a kid. And by the 60s, by high school time, I was regularly going out to California for comic book and fantasy and sci-fi cons, or actually little pedestrian affairs held in a small room in a hotel where just people that loved comics and sci-fi got together, the authors, the artists, the readers, the fans, the dealers, and had a
sort of the early version of FANEX, wasn't it? I mean, we have these big grand events now.
It's nothing to do with these pop culture 100,000 attendee things that you can't even buy tickets to these days, like San Diego Con or our own version, FANEX.
But in that kind of experience as a young man, I mean, you were going to a lot of musical events as well, were you not?
Oh, by the 60s, yeah. Concerts. I mean, I never made the Rolling Stones at Lagoon in 66. Going to Davis County from South Salt Lake when you don't have a driver's license is you might as well think you're going to Woodstock, man. It was hard to get to. It's too far to walk. And I wouldn't have known how to take I knew how to take a bus downtown.
Did you get to the Terrace Ballroom or to the Coliseum at the fairgrounds?
The Terrace Ballroom, the Freed family founded what we fondly knew as the Terrace Ballroom in the 1920s as the Freed Motor Company. And then they shut it down for reasons that I don't know, and it became the
Coconut
Grove. Then it became the Rainbow Rendezvous, and then it became the Terrace Ballroom. And Earl Holding tore it down in 1980, and it's been a parking lot
ever since.
Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention were the last band that closed the Terrace Ballroom down.
What a great venue.
I saw Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company there. We didn't know who she was. This band comes out, they play a set, and then this diminutive hippie chick walks out, clutching a bottle of whiskey that years later I would learn was Southern Comfort. And she comes up, she takes a big belt off that bottle and just starts going, and everybody's, who is that hippie chick? By the time they got to the East Coast on that tour, the posters were saying Janis Joplin in giant letters.
Yeah, instead of the Holding Company.
With Big Brother and the Holding Company in tiny letters, because fame happened that fast in those days. They were Heady Time, Donovan, Jefferson, Airplane, Country Joe and the Fish, all the Bay Area bands. Because of an accident of geography, we were a day's bus drive from the Bay. When they cut an album, they went on tour.
And they were ended that up here. Segue or that they place all, to stop and regas up, and
they all came through here, and I saw so many of them, great and small. One of my favorite memories, one of the Lagoon concerts I did make it to, was for the Electric Prunes. Hardly anybody remembers them today. They were a one-hit wonder band. They had their big hit was "I Had Too Much to Dream Last Night." I had too much to dream. There were so few people at that concert, Brad, that one of the Prunes came down and sat with us at the break because they could tell we were enthusiasts.
Well, okay, so let's talk about the beginnings of the Cosmic Airplane period, and this was one of the periods of your life where you were involved with book dealing or selling books, but doing so in head shops.
Steve Jones and Sherm Clow opened the Cosmic Airplane at 9th and 9th in Salt Lake City, next door to Phillips Gallery. That's where Bonnie and Dennis got their starts.
And that was a place where they showed films sometime.
Well,
and
it
was
somewhat
counterculture.
The Blue Mouse Art Theater, Blue Mouse later. Tower Theater, still there at 9th and 9th. Doesn't have the towers anymore.
And so that's where the store started. How did you get involved with these individuals?
I happened to hear about it. I wandered in one Saturday. I think I bought a psychedelic poster for 50 cents and met Steve. And we just got along and hung out a lot together. And a yearish later, he was able to lease this gigantic space over in like this no man's land of downtown Salt Lake City, 1969-70. It was not quite on the corner of 4th South and West Temple was Ben's Railroad Exchange. It was a real working man's bar. And the Waiters and Porters Club was across the street in the depot. It was 1969. White people and black people couldn't drink in the same bars here in Salt Lake City. It seems completely and utterly inconceivable.
We don't often think that we have Jim Crow, but we did.
Oh, man,
I mean, the only places that people could stay and were mentioned in the Green Book was on North Temple. There were three or four places, and then the YMCA.
They wouldn't let Ella Fitzgerald famously stay at the Hotel Utah.
So these bars, you're on South Temple and 4th?
North. Fourth West.
Fourth West. It's where now is the Vivint Smart Home Arena.
The steps up to it.
And this is also really the epicenter between the two railroad stations and the industrial Salt Lake City.
It was a no man's land in those days. Nobody went down there. Dang near killed Steve's business.
Going that far into
West Salt Lake. It was huge. They had a leather company in there. The Human Ensemble Theaters began and started performing plays in this cavernous back room. A lot of very famous Utahns started out in that little repertory theater. They did. I remember watching them perform Alice in Wonderland back in those days. Smoke or Rocks and Gravels Blues Band got their start in that back room.
So what years again are these?
69 through the early 70s.
And tell me those bars again that were...
Oh, no, 68, actually.
68.
Steve only was at 9th and 9th for maybe a year, because that's when I met Bruce Phillips. And he ran for the U.S. Senate on the Peace and Freedom ticket in Salt Lake City in 1968. Lost, of course.
Interesting.
And he was just then becoming Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the great Southwest.
And he carried on and had quite an interesting career in music and folk
later
music.
In the 70s, when we started the First South Blue Mouse Cosmic Airplane, that most people, that's the one they remember. We had a whole series of concerts of Bruce Phillips there, along with his oftentimes performer Rosalie Sorrells, the traveling lady from Idaho that lived here in those days, in the 60s at least. Just really, really heady times. We had Ed Abbey come and Barry Lopez. It was really exciting times.
This is a counterculture, one of the places people went to get their books, to get their posters, to get their head shop material.
We certainly had, the head shop was the core of it, but it was a counterculture, the only draft counseling center during the Vietnam War that ever existed here was a room at the Cosmic Airplane.
So tell me again, I just want to reframe your comments about South Temple. West South Temple. It's now where the Vivint Smart Home Arena is. And you were talking about bars. And tell me a little more about that.
Well, yeah, there was Ben's Railroad Exchange. There was one on both sides of us. I can't even remember the other one now. The Greyhound Depot was just on the corner of, I think, on 2nd West, South Temple.
Yeah, so it once was the Interurban Railroad Station.
Yes,
that
exactly.
Became and it's now where Bravenel Hall is located. But that whole area was very much a no man's land.
No one went there. People were scared to go to that part of Salt Lake. And Mrs. Taylor's Cafe was around the corner on a back alley. Ophelia Taylor had the best Southern food ever served in this town. She used to feed all the Utah Stars players, the ABA champions, precursors to the Utah Jazz, if you will. Because they didn't make any money playing basketball.
That's it.
So she never had menus. She never had prices. She would look you up and down. She would serve you whatever by gum she was serving that day. And she would charge you whatever the heck she felt like charging you. You might eat for free or you might pay for one or two others.
and you didn't... back talk either. You just paid the lady.
Oh, you no. There was no arguing with Miss Taylor.
Okay,
she was a legend in this town.
So when you started this interaction, you were the book dealer side of these enterprises.
Yeah, and so Steve in the South Temple Cosmic, he let me put in a giant magazine rack and stuffed it full of comic books, fantasy, science fiction, horror, all illustrated books, all the things I was into then. And I used to, and even though I was still a teenager, I was still in high school, Steve never had two nickels to rub together. So on like a Friday, I would loan him $50 and he would go over to the Greyhound depot and get his shipment of incense and brass bells and stuff out of Hawk
and, well,
and sell them over the weekend.
At the Greyhound bus station, they would have cash on delivery.
Yes, CODs.
Companies would say, okay, you're not a stable enough person. We'll mail it to you, but before you pick it up, you not only pay for shipping, but you pay the price of the objects you're
buying.
That's
correct. So Monday after the big, because the weekends were his big times, sales times, and he would pay me back my $50. And we didn't do it necessarily every single week.
But you helped him along.
And but he would just, you know, he was so, I don't know, liberal isn't the word. He was just so, he was totally experimental, willing to let anybody try anything, no matter how stupid it was. He'd give you a chance. And then, of course, he famously got himself in a little bit of trouble with the Securities and Exchange Commission because he always had wanted a coffee house. This was Steve's dream. So they started one. Well, they started selling shares to invest in the coffee house. Apparently, that got... The Securities and Exchange Commission
controls. It wasn't quite to
the legal
specs.
They just started
specs.
Printing them up and selling them. They didn't bother to register. Who knew, right?
But again, it's that kind of experimental entrepreneurism.
Steve didn't have a phone, but there was a payphone inside Cosmic that the public could use. But they charge you for that, too. So... Steve always had these little index cards posted next to the payphone. So if you used it, you were supposed to, the FBI was actually wiretapping it and they were paying the phone bill because Steve could never pay it, but it never, ever got turned off for years.
Interesting. Now, when you say the card, was the card to slip in so you could get the coin back?
No, they were to make the FBI felt like they were getting their money's worth by their... eavesdropping. So, the shipment, it's tonight at midnight at the park, right? Raul will be there. Just cryptic things like that.
You'd make up a card and read it into your conversation.
Yeah. Well, that way they would keep tapping the phone and paying the bill.
Well, you've been listening to the podcast Speak Your Peace, where writers, historians, and contributors to Utah's history share their insights and discoveries. Today's guest has been Ken Sanders, from Ken Sanders Rare Books here in Salt Lake City. In our next Speak Your Peace segment, we'll be continuing our conversation with Ken on just about anything that interests him, and we hope you'll remain with us on Speak Your Peace. Ken, you've been this collector since you were just nearly in grade school. What are some of the enduring collections that you have had over the years? Or I understand your father also had collections. So,
interestingly enough, and maybe we need a psychiatrist for this one, Brad. Dad, I mean, he had books like in relations to his collections, but Dad was never a book collector per se. Dad was the black hole of Utah collecting. He turned the old garage behind the house into his antique bottle museum. Had backlit shelves, glass shelves to display all the wonderful colors of the bottles and the insulators. And he just never ever quit. There's too many stories to tell. He bought everything that the diggers and the scouts brought him, and he paid whatever price they said. Mm. The old Utah drugstore bottles, you know, that were ubiquitous, West Side Drug. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds. The Ryder Brothers drugstore in Logan, they're embossed. Later on, they're paper label. But the really early days when they're bimol bottles, which means blown in mold, applied lip.
And the names are actually in the glass.
Yeah, so the lettering is embossed. Well, some of them are trying to find an embossed drugstore from like a small town is near impossible, unlike the big ones here in Salt Lake. So my father, and I still have the collection. It's in storage and it's boxed up, and I don't know what to do with it. it consists of, and I haven't counted them, but I would guesstimate Dad's embossed Utah drugstore collection is between 2,000 to 3,000 different bottles.
Well, it's got to be of historical value.
It is, but I don't know of, help me out here, I don't know of any place in the state that would know what to do with it, would even have a clue that it's historical or would appreciate it, let alone could afford to maintain it or house it.
And he also was a postcard collector.
Dad's postcard collection, I've unfortunately been decimating it because I just couldn't keep it all together. I've been doing a series of sales and donations to our various institutions from Utah State and Weber down to Cedar City and primarily the Marriott Library here over the recently retired, our friend,
Greg Thompson, Dr. Greg Thompson.
Dr. Thompson could see the vision of having my late father's postcard collection had over 25,000 different Utah postcards in it.
So the postcard collecting is artifact, but it's also visual and images. It's about the sometimes the kind of commercial deceit of people changing images to.
That's a good point. But it's also a cultural history.
Such a big deal.
The pictorial, without going into the whole thing, picture postcards, roughly they come in, they're not called postcards, they're called private mailing cards and other things. They come in about 1893-ish at the Chicago's World Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1907, the U.S. government, the early forms of postcards with pictures on them, you only could put the name and address on the backside, if you will.
You had to leave all that open space.
There was no message. When they changed the law in 1907.
Is that when the one penny thing came in?
Well, they were always a penny. But now you could put a message on the left side and the address on the right side, and they exploded. Postcard collecting clubs sprang up. I mean, it was bigger than Pet Rocks. It was bigger than hula hoops. Well, it was big.
And for Utah, it was an opportunity to see the everyday photos, the little town commercial areas,
yes.
The streets. I mean, some of them are incredibly boring, but so historically rich.
It's a cult, especially because they sprang up virtually at the beginning of the 20th century. They're a cultural and visual history of small town America and small business America of the 20th century.
Well, I'm glad you're donating or selling to
these
various.
The LDS Church has a bunch of them as well. I forgot to mention
them. It's so
them.
Good to have them there where they can be
preserved forever.
And cared for.
Yes.
So let's talk about your personal collections. I mean, you've been someone on the Antiques Roadshow for 15 seasons. I always love to see those episodes where Ken Sanders is standing there interacting.
It's probably the most unusual thing. I certainly never anticipated myself being a rare books and manuscripts appraiser for Antiques Roadshow. To date, they've been to Salt Lake City 3 times now. The very first time they came, my daughter and I, I didn't have employees back then, and they did things differently then, and you had to go wait in line, and then you couldn't get in because it was so popular. So we ended up holding a de facto antique roadshow at my bookstore downtown. Melissa was like the air traffic controller, and there were all these people that couldn't get in, and they were kind of upset about it. So they brought their stuff
to
me. So
they channeled that through you, and people could come to your shop and do the same.
Then later in the afternoon, the people that had gotten in and gotten their appraisals, especially on Utah and Mormon material, were disgruntled because because Antiques Roadshow did not have a person on staff, did not have an appraiser that
for
knew
the region.
Anything about it. And that was a botch. They realized when they came back, one of the producers called me up and I've been trying to find someone that can do Utah and Mormon artifacts for us. And every single person I talked to gives me your name. So I walk over there at the Salt Palace, walk over from my shop, and they just threw me into the mix, and 15 years later, I'm still doing it.
And you travel. You don't just do the ones here in Utah.
No, we travel. We travel all over the country on our own. The biggest fallacy of the Antique Roadshow, all of us appraisers, just like the local volunteers, we are volunteers. We pay our own way, our airfares, our hotels. They do provide a meal the day of, a breakfast and a lunch, if you can take time to eat it. And we're awfully busy. I mean, we look at hundreds and hundreds of items and trying to find something elusive and rare to go on air. And just because we think it's worthy, oh, no, the producers decide, not us.
Oh, so even though you may find something of deep interest to you, if it doesn't quite have that combination of public appeal, it's not going to happen.
It's real serendipity. And plus, maybe they've done it before.
Oh,
and that shoots it down right there. I've had some great ones. Some of my favorite ones aren't the ones worth the most money. It's because the guest was so personable, mm-hmm. or the item was just so interesting. We could weave a story out of it. It's hard to just pick one.
I just want to say that is where history and commercial enterprise kind of don't relate or work, because sometimes the most meaty and interesting history doesn't come along with the highest value.
No, not at all.
And those stories, I think oftentimes people think only what's valuable is what's valuable in a commercial sense. And as a public historian, I can tell you that is not the case. But tell us a story or two, Ken.
Bessica Raich. I think a woman came in, and she was somehow it had been passed down to her. It was a mini archive of letters and various things and photographs of one Bessica Raich. Well, who's Bessica Raich, you might add? I never heard of her. And now I'm supposed to be the expert, okay? But things don't always work out the way they're supposed to be. I managed to interview the lady with this archive in such a manner that I let her tell me about it, and we just had fun with it and went on a voyage of discovery together. And I felt like we made a real contribution, because I'm guessing you've never heard of Bessica Raich.
Nope.
She was one of the very first female aviatrix.
From Utah?
No.
That's right. You're beyond.
I don't even know what city I was in.
You're right. This is beyond Utah.
No, not from Utah. She did everything Amelia Earhart did, plus she designed and built her own planes and flew them. No one's ever heard of this woman. So we had a ball with showing the photographs, and then the story was heartbreaking. She had a real Neanderthal of a husband. He destroyed most of her archives upon her death.
Wow. And this person who would otherwise perhaps have a place in history or would be better known.
So we at least got the ball rolling. I have probably had more people contact me after the show for her than all the others put together, people wanting to tell that story.
Well, and that kind of process of discovery, oftentimes in the show, as I see it, is people have a pretty good idea before the cameras go on as to what they're going to say. You went through a kind of an exploratory process.
They do edit, of course, just like you can edit your podcast, mm-hmm. But it's live. I mean, we're in front of an audience there's no scripts. Mm-hmm. It's just, you have no idea what the guest is going to say.
Ken, do you interact with the other dealers? One thing I noticed as I listened to the show is a lot of times it sounds like y'all parlay and, you know, get advice and understand things better together.
The more you do it, you build it, you know who knows what. So we're all the time running stuff back and forth to our various sectors. There's about 80 appraisers at any given show, and the Antique Roadshow appraises perhaps in 23, 24 different categories. And so we'll send stuff to people that can do a better job with it.
But and have you not expanded your own knowledge base from interacting with all these?
As hard as it can be when you're dealing with this completely unknown material, like I'm not capable of appraising Persian manuscripts and ancient Hebrew
items. You can
items.
Admire them, but you've got to move them to another specialist.
Well, or it was probably not one that can do them.
Oh, I see. There's some times where you've come to a dead end or...
Yeah, but you can also give... And then people bring in... You're only allowed to bring a couple of items, but under the guise of, oh, it's an archive or a collection, they wheel in a, you know, this, you know, hand truck full of boxes. And it's like, what can you tell me about it? Sometimes they're super organized. Sometimes they don't even know. And I said, look, if an archive like this comes into my shop, the first thing we're going to do is spend weeks or months researching it. The last thing we're going to do is put a value on it. In the context of the minutes we have here, there's no way to appraise a collection like this. We don't even know what's in it. Well, and so we have to, I can usually give them some kind of ballpark. It's pretty loose. Mm-hmm. And plus, depending, you know, I've done this for so long. Well, an archive of X, like, well, nobody cares about X, but oh, Y. Oh, man, everybody loves Y. Y is really hot right now.
So that kind of cherry picking within a particular body of material, you can identify those.
One of the, my very first time, and I didn't get to appraise it because my very first Salt Lake show, I sat down, the little old lady in a wheelchair, and she had a first edition 1851 pearl of great price, but it had the salmon wrappers on it. Mm-hmm. 99% of those books do not have the wrappers, and quite a rarity.
And this idea is that it's a paper covering, so there's no binding, and they would produce them often in different colors, and that particular color was fairly rare.
Well, just any wrapper. You don't see wrappers on the pearl. They were mostly made to be bound into.
You took them with the wrappers, things. They ripped them off, and they bound them.
No, they never had wrappers, in my opinion.
Oh. I thought you were saying people bound them up, and that's why they're rare.
That could happen, but I believe why the pearl wrappers are so rare. In 1851, everything's being printed in Liverpool by the LDS Church. They don't have any money. They're desperately poor. They're not going to spend extra money printing wrappers when they know that they're going to bound them into volumes of Millennial Stars or Orson Pratt pamphlets, what have you. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I can prove that, but I believe it.
So this lady had this salmon wrapper.
Yeah, and then, so that day, I'm trying to keep this, it's hard to keep it brief. I'm sorry, Brad. Everybody was coming to me. So I like filmed three centers, which they don't even let you do that anymore. If you get a center, you're lucky, where you do the full 3-minute thing.
Oh, and that
and I had such a excess of treasures that I had to give them away. And the Margetts family, they were a pioneer theater family here.
Absolutely. He was the director of the Salt Lake Theater Company, was he not? Or the Salt Lake Theater that was raised in the 1920s.
Well, it haunts me because I helped as best I could. I believe it was a gentleman from Christie's. He went on and filmed it. But it was a monstrous treasure trove of original daguerreotypes and carte de visites and Brigham Young letters, correspondence, some of the earliest, rarest Salt Lake Theater stuff I've ever seen.
Such a big part of the culture of Salt Lake.
Even it goes beyond the actual building and opening of the Salt Lake Theater in 1862. It was a treasure trove of, oh.
Wow.
That one haunts me. That was one of the best archives that ever came in. And then this other family, they brought in a textile broadside, if you will, but it's a textile and it's big. You know, it's 2.5-3 feet. It's Charles Ellis Johnson's family. They came from the Midwest. They migrated to Great Salt Lake City in the early days, and Dad ran some kind of mercantile, and I've forgotten the details, somewhere in the Midwest, and this textile broadside was advertising to Mormons and other immigrants heading west to stop in and buy stuff from the Johnsons.
Wow.
And it's one of a kind. It haunts me. They've been into my, this would have been 15 years ago. I ran into one of them. I never would have known them. They brought it up. They still have it, but I can't get it loose.
Well, Ken, tell us about stories in your shop. What are those? You have one or two great finds. You know, what I love about rare book collectors and dealers is there's those great stories of finds.
Well, we're going to touch on him. I don't want to dwell on him. By the late 70s, a fellow came along that was making great local Mormon finds. And then he would find them every month, every week, every day.
That is the Mr. Mark
Kaufman.
Kaufman.
Yeah. Bomber, murderer, forger, Mark Kaufman, the recent Netflix film.
Of which you are prominently a part of, by the way.
I don't have television and I don't watch TV.
You hold up fairly well.
The last thing I would watch on TV is myself.
So
in a career in rare books and manuscripts, you live for the find of a lifetime. Once upon a time, a young newlywed Mormon couple came in with three books that had been in a secret drawer in grandma's, you know, bureau. Two of them were just ordinary things. And the third one, I'd never seen one before. And I said, look, I would need to authenticate this because I didn't think it was a reprint, but I'd never seen it before. And of course, what I'm talking about is the rarest Mormon book, the Book of Commandments, 1833, destroyed by an angry anti-Mormon mob. Not just the book. The book never got printed.
Yeah, it was never completed, was it? I mean, they pulled together the signatures and sewn them together.
From flying in the wind and under the skirt of the alleged Leitner girls, gathered some up, put them on their skirts, whatever. Since 1833, there have been 29 extant copies of that book surface in 181 years. Will there be a 30th? Who knows? And most of them are incomplete. Duh.
They are. They're always incomplete. And some people I know, Wilford Woodruff's copy that the church has, he handwrites the last sections to fill, kind of complete it.
So my colleagues at the LDS Church were kind enough to trot out Woodruff's copy and another copy and mine. Well, I brought mine over, and I held all three of them in my hands. Three Book of Commandments. Top that.
I can't.
And I was able to authenticate it. And back then, I think we sold it for a couple of $100,000. It's an incomplete book. I don't expect that I will ever, ever. I've certainly seen some sense, but I've never been able to be involved.
And their values are far more than what you sold that for.
We're a million plus now, even with pages missing, which is very unusual because usually missing pages means no value. But there are exceptions to every rule.
Absolutely. Well, Ken, I'd like to ask a few questions about just the book dealing business in general. Altogether 50 years at different venues. You started your own Ken Sanders Books in 1980-something?
Yeah, well, my first real business was, I called it the Dream Garden Press Mausoleum, Inc., because I was a teenager and it appealed to me. And that was a mail order business. I sold underground comic books like Zap and R. Crumb, even though I had on my ads, they had to say you must be 18 or over to buy these comics. I wasn't 18, but heck, I was selling them, not buying them. And I sold, you know, Frank Frazetta and sci-fi and comic books and Rackham and Dulac.
What magazines did you put your ads in?
Oh, fanzines, Herbdom, Rocket Blast Comic Collector. And I didn't know what typesetting was, so I'd go to Rules Photo Blue and buy endless letters or rub off lettering. And that one I learned I have no talent as a graphic artist. Everything, the lines always ran crooked and downhill, and I'd get my dirty fingerprints all over the layout sheets. I was terrible at it.
Well, so but really, it wasn't the 1980s, it was the early 60s.
Yeah, the 60s.
Started then, your
and I actually, my first job in the book trade was a man named Don Bowles had gone bankrupt in the oil trade out in the Uinta Basin, and he opened Utah's first paperback trade shop in Sugar House called Central Book Exchange. It's still there and doing well, thriving to this day. Different owners, of course. And Saturdays and after school, I would run the place for him, and, you know, you make 10 cents off trading books with people. So my salary was supposed to be a dollar an hour. But most days we didn't take enough money in to actually pay such an inflated salary. So I took it out in trade.
So every time
I was in heaven.
You could just get more of what you really wanted.
Right. So then the high school years, I did my mail order. And then I worked on and off in the late 60s, early 70s for Salt Lake's most famous bookman, Sam Weller. As I like to tell the story, Sam hired me 5 times and fired me 10 times. I know the math doesn't add up, but I swear to you it's true.
You just kept coming back to work.
I worked for a printer for a while, played cowboy in my youth, and then Steve approached me in the early 70s to manage. He had always really wanted to have a bookstore. So along with Bruce Roberts, Steve Jones, the founder, the three of us founded Laughing Dragon Enterprises, Inc., DBA, Cosmic Aeroplane Books and Records. And then I worked on it for a whole year, 1975, in my old house. We finally found the property next to the Blue Mouse on First South, an old film row, just up the street from the Cine Grill. Mm-hmm. And we opened a bookstore, head shop, gift shop, record shop, jewelry shop.
Tell us the address exactly.
It was 258 East, First South, next door to what was Universal Supply Theater and the old Blue Mouse art film. Mm-hmm. Trent Harris, Scott Carrier, a whole bunch of folks had offices in the second floor of the Blue Mouse building. Mike Ehrman ran the Blue Mouse, usually into the ground. And we just gave a bookstore, and what if nobody came? Well, it was Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. By the time my partners forced me out of the business in the early 80s, Cosmic Aeroplane, and I created the bookstore we ran. I had a comic book department. That's when I issued my first rare Utah and the Mormons catalog one, and I got my hands on my very first 1830 Book of Mormon and sold it for the fantastical sum of $5,000. Yeah. That's really marked my entry. I was exposed to Western Americana and Mormonism at Weller's, of course, mm-hmm. but that wasn't my passion. But you would be some sort of fool to be an antiquarian book dealer in this state and not deal in Utah and Mormon materials. Regardless of whether you're LDS or not, Mormon history is endlessly fascinating, and you cannot tell the history of the West without telling the history of the Mormons. And when I say history, I don't mean the vitriolic anti-Mormon screed that came out of the 19th century and some in the 20th, or the faith-promoting fluff often put out by Deseret Book or Bookcraft. I mean real history. Mm-hmm. And I think we're in an era that's much, much more open than it ever has been in my lifetime.
There's some amazing history that brings us into the context of the greater Western experience and the national experience. It's inescapable. Well, and this area of collecting is, as I understand it, just as strong as like Texana or some of these other areas. A lot of people find Mormon stories interesting.
Yes. So 1980, I never could get this book called Faded Footprints, A History of the Lost Roads Mine. in. It was self-published out of print. One day, the author walks in. Oh, I've got this manuscript of this book. Would you publish it?
Dream Garden.
That's when I went over to Zions Bank to my buddy there, and he just gave me a signature loan for $5,000, and I published my very first book. And I've been Dream Garden Press. It doesn't have any employees. There's no sales department. And I only publish books seemingly these days that I want to. So that means they're pretty much, if they actually made their printing cost back, they would be a wild success. but I still keep it going. I've published Kate McLeod and Utah Phillips songbooks. I've published Alex Caldero poetry. I just publish stuff I want to.
And in doing so, I think you've created quite a body of wonderful material that many other people enjoy.
My most famous was I commissioned Robert Crumb, the underground cartoonist, to illustrate Edward Abbey's The Monkey Ranch Gang, and I published the 10th anniversary edition, and that was in 1985, and it's still in print all these years later.
Wow. Well, you've been listening to the podcast Speak Your Piece, where writers, historians, and contributors to Utah's history share their insights and discoveries. Today's guest has been Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. I hope you'll continue with us as we learn more about the life and times of Ken Sanders. Welcome back. We have Ken Sanders here, and we've been talking about, well, a lot of things, counterculture, book dealing, Utah in the mid-20th century. Ken, let's talk about the travails and the exploits, the love, the terror of book dealing in these contemporary times.
The time has come, the walrus said, to speak of many things, of ships that sail with sealing wax and pigs that fly with wings. From Through the Looking Glass by Lewis Carroll. That's one of my sacred totem books of my childhood. I just can't get enough of Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. The book trade, ordinary people, they don't understand what we do. I want an appraisal. I have a first edition. Well, no, you don't have a first edition. You just know that that word means something good. And so you say it, but you have no idea whether you would have a first edition or not. And there's first edition, first printing, and I don't want to confuse your audience. Look, every book ever printed has a first edition, right? Mercifully, most of them only ever got that because
they
didn't deserve even that. And then you get into something, a mega popular, let's use Harry Potter. Well, certain online auction sites have become the largest legalized purveyors of stolen goods or fraud in the world. Mm. So what they'll say in the headline with all cap letters and exclamation points, Harry Potter, exclamation, first edition, more exclamation points. They have a whole bag of them they use. And then if you read the fine print on page 8, it says the 56th printing of the first edition. The 7th Harry Potter book in America, they printed 9 million copies.
So it's the
first printing of the first edition that matters. And yeah, anyone in the book trade, we use shorthand, first edition. But that eBay seller, they're deceptive, but they won't throw them off because they did disclose it. But it's not, you're never going to see that. It's an 8-point print buried on the 12th page of the listing.
Well, and so that this is part of the changing life of book dealers now.
What I do doesn't make sense to anyone, including myself, and especially now with the internet, if it ever made sense, it doesn't now. It's this weird arcane knowledge. The knowledge is more widespread with the internet, but you have to be able to interpret what you're reading, and people can't do that. They'll look up a book an online, and they'll see it selling from $12 to $1,200 or $12,000. Well, they bring it into me with the printout of the $12,000 one, but that isn't what they have. And then some of the most oddest concepts, the book itself, it's a 20th century literature, and I realize we're on radio, I'm using a demonstration here, has a dust jacket, this paper wrapper.
So Ken's got a book, and he's...
I'm taking the dust jacket off. Okay, I'm making all this up. It was a $1,000 book with the jacket on it. Now it's worth $20.
Yeah, because the dust jacket is more important.
The book isn't what's valuable. It's the paper wrapper because it came with it. And people will start, they don't understand that. They don't get it. But 90% of the copies in existence, if they even have a dust jacket, it isn't in this kind of condition.
Yeah.
It's ripped up and beat up.
Well, then even worse is people then replicate those dust jackets and make it look like.
Yes, there's that.
So there's all good. You know, for me, as I have worked for years and years interacting with book dealers, you guys are here for a reason. You have the kind of deep knowledge, but you also have the sources and information, and it's vital.
Every good bookseller has a deep passion and knowledge of the subject and a willingness to share with others. We take pride and joy in teaching others. It can be tedious sometimes because people get mad because I'm in the business of telling people what they don't want to hear, and then they don't want to listen because they want to think that they're To Kill a Mockingbird, Grapes of Wrath, Gone with the Wind, On the Road, what have you, is the money one. And they don't want to hear you telling them, and it isn't.
Yeah.
And every book has, yeah, some are easy. They state first edition, but you have to, every single publisher marks a first edition or not in a different way. And you have to know every single one of those ways. And mostly you have to have that information in your head.
And then there's like book club editions and
book paperback. Taiwanese pirates. Yeah, paperback, pretty easy. There are collectible paperbacks, but and it's just, it's a, and plus the supply chain and source, it's better than it ever was because the, I mean, there's millions and millions of books online, but 90% of them are worthless and nobody wants them or the condition's horrible. Condition is everything to value. Because the vast majority of the books that still exist are in compromised value. And what makes a book valuable? It's somebody wanting it.
Yeah.
And I don't control that. No one controls. Publishers, authors, booksellers, book readers, none of us control it. It's a weird thing. And the good thing the internet has done is democratized the knowledge, but it hasn't provided any interpretive tools. So it makes people more clueless than ever because there's too much information out there and a lot of it is wrong.
So Ken, all these years in the book dealer trade, you started out with catalogs and retail shops, and now on the internet, just last night I was looking over the books that you have for sale, and you're involved in the internet as much as you are in a brick-and-mortar place. What has been the most transformative things in your career with book dealing? I mean, I don't know. I mean, is there more to it than what I just said?
Without question, the internet. It's just changed everything. It's you know, it's the best of times, the worst of times, as Dickens said. It enables us to reach audiences that would never set foot in an open shop and gives us ways of selling things we have no other way of selling. It's harder to keep secrets. If you have the only copy of a book that's worth thousands of dollars and you put it online at your price, I will absolutely guarantee you a whole bunch of previously unknown copies will come out of the woodwork, but they want to sell it to you at the price you're trying to sell it for. And that doesn't quite work.
Well, and inescapably, you're here to make money and it's a business. And so people sometimes will be threatened by that.
Oh, yeah. And we... I mean, we personally, Ken Sanders Rare Books, we struggle to keep maybe 10,000-12,000 books online, although our book hounding, as we call it, our cataloging is in, we have cataloged 65,000 books over the past 25 years that I've been in the second East store. And the challenge is the space, the prices collapsing because of the internet, the markets changing, how you buy and sell. In the old days, you would have customers that would buy exclusively from you. There's not any loyalty like that left. One thing we haven't touched upon is the university and the institutional trade. You build up a lifetime of relationships with special collections people. Mm-hmm. Here it would be at the LDS Church, BYU, the Marriott Library at the University of Utah, Weber State, Utah State. You know, that's most of the players. Mm-hmm. And around the country there, it's a real personal relationship. There are people both on the dealer side and the librarian or institutional side that don't think much of each other. Mm-hmm. But I'm here to tell you, there are ways that institutional colleagues, librarians, archivists, etc., and those of us in the trade can work and help each other tremendously, especially with landing large archives to be donated to institutions. I've done it my whole life.
I've often thought that it's like this big ecology and everyone plays a part, and ignoring yes. some sector in the ecology is sort of ridiculous. Yep. You know,
perfect.
And they're all involved, and they can work together in a way that is beneficial to the greater good in society. And I think you've done that in so many of your collections, eventually going into institutions, that'll be there forevermore and benefit not scholars today, right. but many more.
Sometimes it's done through sales, but often it's done. I've arranged countless donations to all of those aforementioned institutions over the years, and I'll continue to do so as long as I last. Our trade, it's changing. The internet, the COVID, you know, over a year ago, my friends kind of forced me into doing a GoFundMe. And it has been the most overwhelming and humbling experience I've done in my life. Some 3,000 people have donated money to save Ken Sanders Rare Books. We're approaching, our goal was $250,000. We've raised almost $160,000 from 3,000 people. Yeah, I know a few hundred of them. They all get thank yous from me. The ones that get to me the most, Brad, are the people giving me $5 and $10 because you know they care. Mm-hmm. They're passionate, and they don't really have any money, but they're going to give it anyway. Those really get to me. I'm grateful for every one of them.
Well, and you've been in this business and have been part of the Salt Lake community for 50 years. And people having an opportunity to slip into Ken Sanders Books, or let's describe some of the other book dealers that you would recommend people to go to.
Well, yes, our old timers are the Sam Wellers, now being run by Tony and Catherine Weller, and
Weller's Works.
Relocated from Main Street of 50 years to Trolley Square. Kurt Bench, whom we just lost to heart problems at age 68.
Mm-hmm. And Kurt, his son Chris is still there.
Yeah, he's still running Benchmark. Kurt got his start as a new book manager at Benchmark Books, and then they just fatefully decided to start a Rare Book Time store at the same time that Mark Hoffman came along mm-hmm. and fleeced them and everybody else. Kent Shantz, a former employee of mine, has a different model. He works strictly on the internet and out of his house and issues catalogs and works behind the scenes with the institutions we've talked about. There's the legendary Utah Book and Magazine on mm-hmm. Main Street that is, you just have to experience
going
it. It's a third generation.
Yeah.
I used to buy comic books from Pete Marshall's grandfather when I was a kid. And there's a whole tons of newer ones that have come up. There's a Marissa's bookshop. There's Central Book that I mentioned. I mean,
it's still
talk
going.
About long-lived.
Yeah. How about King's English?
The King's English is one of our finest new bookstores in the Valley. Betsy has recently sold it. And it's going to, I think, thrive under its new ownership. And, I mean, they have just been hammered with COVID. And, you know, we sell some new books, but I don't have to sell new books to stay alive. So they've really suffered from COVID. And Betsy, I've known since my Cosmic Airplane days. She's a dear friend.
Well, and to me, this is an essential part of the intellectual life of a community, of an urban area like Salt Lake City. And so this is why I have you on the podcast
and
today.
What I'm doing isn't really sustainable anymore. And by that, I mean, if I had a brain, I'd just close up the open shop. I have the aforementioned bottle museum. I could just do an appointment only or internet only and only handle 3, 4, 5 and the occasional 6-figure book.
Interesting, but it's good to have you here in town.
We have 10,000 literary paperbacks and hardbacks and all subjects that cost from $3 to $10. And kids, college kids, young people, non-book collectors, they count on it. And in this age of having 101 different devices that clamor for your attention and take you away from old-fashioned books, I'm really, really proud of the quality of what the young, and our demographics are skewing younger every single day. These young peoples are readers, no matter what other people say. They're buying really good books. But that model of selling books, bookstores thrive in cheap rents of seedy downtown areas, like the aforementioned Cosmic Airplane location. Yes. We'll try and rent there now, pal. And maybe other than Detroit, I don't think you can get cheap rent in any major downtown. Yeah. What I'm doing isn't sustainable anymore, and something has got to change. And that's why I put out the GoFundMe. It's still open. You can, if you wish to, you can contribute to it. And if you want to know more about me, there's a ton of it online through my friends, Eric Temple and the musician Kate McLeod. I don't do anything regularly very well, but we created a YouTube channel, a Ken Sanders YouTube channel. And I've got about a dozen different hour-long children's book shows that I read books to children. And also, I've started what I call the Ammo Can Library, where I read my favorite readings that I've done over the years on camping and river trips. Hence, the Ammo Can Library with Ken Sanders. I do everything.
Take that little ammo can, that container everywhere you go, and you pop it up, and there's two or three books there.
Kate and I recorded Gertrude Stein 2 years ago in the Grand Canyon. Done Edward Abbey and just all my favorites.
I've listened. They're wonderful. Well, Ken, you've brought a few books. Let's
From the Ammo Can.
Let's pull out that book from the Ammo Can and read a selection.
Wendell Berry is the author of more than 60 books. His first novel was Nathan Coulter in 1960. He's a farmer. He's a novelist. He's an essayist. He's a poet. He's
American treasure.
I believe he is a national treasure, and I believe he's the most important living writer we have in this country. He's a plain-spoken man, but he always speaks the truth. And I don't know if, can we do two poems?
Please.
You can edit and kill it if it's too long. This is my favorite because it'll be a counterpoint to the other one. Because this one is called The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. The Peace of Wild Things, Wendell Berry.
And as a counterpoint?
Well, Wendell, he's been around for a long time, and he's written a lot, and he's pretty disgusted by the state of things. So this is his, I just think his insight into what we're doing to ourselves and our planet couldn't be more apropos right now. So let me give you Wendell Berry's viewpoint, and we'll end with that, Brad. Let us not condemn the human beings, self-appointed to serve machines, poor humans, so weak of mind, so misled, so willing to risk heroic wrong. What's the satisfaction in condemning the self-condemned? Let them be answered by themselves, who grow smaller, their great works uglier, more lethal, day by day. As we wish ourselves to be spared the fatal numbering, let us not confound offenders with offenses. May they come to mercy and to peace. But damn their bank accounts inflated by the spent breath of all the earth, of species forever changed to money. Let their legal falsehoods, corpses incorporated that cannot see or feel, think or care, that eat the world and shit money, fry in hell in their own fat. May their incarnate steel and fire that destroy the mountains forever be damned. May the chemicals be damned, the poison, the rivers, and damned too, the alien slop and fume that spoil the air, the water, and all the living world, sold, soiled, or burned. May the plastic trash that defiles lands and oceans, the machines that destroy the work of human hands, the mind-destroying mechanical dreams be damned, completely damned. Be damned also to the incorporations of industrial war that is the triumph of every machine that will destroy any life and every life, any place and every place for victory always is defeat. May the heartless speech of machines that break the heart of the smallest wholeness, and may the radiant waste that has made geniuses idiots forever be damned. It's poor religion that can't provide a sufficient curse when needed. But if you condemn the dire shortcuts and devices of the engineers, confess that you condemn yourself. You too belong to that litter, and so must enter your guilty plea, and so must come to your work. You must go ahead in opposition to the mechanical life, continuing also the creaturely task longer in your life of correcting yourself.
Wendell Berry, tell me the title of that poem.
He often doesn't title them. This entire book of his most recent poems is just numbered.
Interesting. Wow. Thank you so much. I think having you read that is also emblematic of your contribution, your feelings about the world and life and how you navigate as a rare book dealer, as a critic, as someone who has some feelings you want to share. And you've done that over the years. Your engagement is not just in the commercial sense. And I think it shares, you're sharing that in those readings. Well,
thank you, Brad. Commercial sense, businessman. What's that? I have a colleague who's been helping me out a lot since COVID, and we get together several times a week. And her mantra is: Ken, you have to quit buying all that. You've got to sell the books you already have. Yes, I know, but. If I stop buying, I'll die. Well, I don't know how.
And I may also say audience that we didn't have time to talk about the book, The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, about John, is it Gilkey?
John Charles Gilkey.
And Ken is part of a group called the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America. He's part of their the theft unit, you could say.
I used to be the security committee way back in the day, and retired.
So if you pick up a copy of that book, you will hear about his involvement in tracking down a book thief.
A book thief that I never met, a book thief that never stole a book from me, but a book thief that probably has stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from my colleagues. And I did manage to send him to San Quentin, but
they're only, what, 18 months or something, sadly?
Yeah, unfortunately, law enforcement with book thieves kind of practices a catch and release policy.
Well, and your author, Allison Hoover Bartlett,
yes,
tried very well, I think, to tell the story of this man and your involvement in catching
him. It's a tale of obsession on both our parts, or maybe all three of our parts.
Well, I'll leave it to you as an audience to track that title down. I think you'll be richly, you'll enjoy it a great deal. Well, please remember to rate and review Speak Your Peace on Apple, Google Podcast, wherever you find your podcast. This was recorded and engineered at Studio Underground here in Salt Lake City, and I thank my sound engineer and post-production editor, Connor Sorensen, from Studio Underground. I also express my special thanks to Spencer Stokes, president of Stokes Strategy, who owns Studio Underground. Past is never really in the past. It's all around us. It informs us. It speaks to our shared and to our separate identities. Speak Your Peace is a podcast where writers, historians, archaeologists, curators, rare book dealers, all who contribute to Utah's history, have a chance to share their insights and discoveries. If there's one place, one podcast to get your Utah history fix, I hope this is the place. Thank you, Ken Sanders, for being here today.
My pleasure.
I hope you'll tune in again to our next episode of Speak Your Peace.